The Comedy Fast Track. That's what's coming up on The Art of Bombing, episode 230.
My friend Dan, he's got a podcast, 'cause all comics need a podcast, and nobody had a podcast called The Art of Bombing. So Dan went out and bought a tape deck. Who knows why he bought a tape deck? Podcasts don't get played on tape decks, but Dan is from the 80s. So hey there, all you funny jerks, come talk to Dan about your work. Tell him all about your worst times. It's The Art of Bombing.
Welcome to a brand new episode of the Art of Bombing podcast. I am your host, Dan Bublish Jr., and with me as always is my co-host and producer, Josh Shirley. How are you doing today?
Pretty good, man. It is a week from tomorrow, and my kid will be out of school. He'll be out of the third grade.
Uh-oh.
And summer starts, pools, all that stuff, man. I'm excited because it'll be one less thing to worry about.
Yeah, school, but then you'll have that one less thing to worry about, and it sounds like with pools and summer activities, a whole brood of other things to worry about.
Yeah, and I'll be shuttling him to a grab bag of summer camps this summer. Like, that's how I'll know when it is what summer camp we're sending him off to, so we can work.
You'll know what time in the summer it is just based on camps. I love it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what we're doing.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. How's your week been going? Good so far?
Yeah, good. I did an open mic this week where I didn't follow one of our between bombs rules on not being offensive. And I told some Canadian jokes to a bunch of Canadians, and they were very Canadian about it, so they laughed. But oh, okay. I could tell when it was time to move on.
Yeah, they were. You could tell they were a little uncomfortable. They were being polite, yes, but you were pushing the limits.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh yeah, I did an open mic this week as well. I didn't have any shows. I'm kind of on. I'm on puppy daddy duty. My partner is out of town for work. She's been out of town for the last week, and she's still gone for a few more days. So I had to like not go on the road this time. Usually I'm gone and she's home, so it's a little bit of a weird switch. But I did go hit an open mic, working out some new stuff. It's getting there. It's processing. Trying to work on a bit that's going to eventually be my new closer, because I got some huge news. My album is finally coming out. Yes.
What?
I recorded it last August, and it's coming out June 3rd. And cool thing is tomorrow it's going to be available for presale. So you can find it and you get your presale copy. I would definitely appreciate people doing that, so it can maybe rise in those iTunes charts. I think that helps comics nowadays. I don't know what does anymore.
Well, I got to get my hands on it, man. So I will be one of those people for sure.
Yeah, it's called Strangers in My Basement. Look for it wherever you get your comedy albums. It'll be available on Amazon Music. It'll be streaming eventually on Spotify. It's available on Amazon. I already said that. I meant Apple. That's the other one.
That's
Apple
right.
Music. Yep. You can get it on my website, danbublitzcomedy.com. All the places. So, yeah, definitely look for that. I'm excited because that's the process. I finally, we talk about comedy and getting better at comedy and trying to evolve on this podcast. And I've been sitting on my album for a while trying to get it tweaked to how I wanted it, because I've recorded way more material than I needed to. And the longer I sat on it, I was starting to feel like, oh, maybe I shouldn't release this. I'm getting to be a better comic than when I recorded it. And then finally I was like, you know what? You can't do that. If you do that, you'll never release anything. So
yeah,
crack down, and now it's coming out.
Absolutely. Well, you make a point that I think, Mr. Mike Merrifield would probably appreciate.
Man, absolutely.
That is that you're putting the work in, you're getting better. What's going to happen on this episode, man?
Well, yeah, you're bringing, talking about this episode, Mike Merrifield, like we mentioned, is on the podcast. He's been doing comedy for a long time, has a lot of great insight on the business, because he's one of these comics that he's probably seen and done it all. He's worked the road vigorously, and lots of great insight. This is a great episode because we're really getting into the nuts and bolts of comedy. It's a lot of comedy shop talk. We're really getting into it and getting kind of the nuts and bolts of it all, which was great. It was a great conversation. He said some things that even I started thinking about after the conversation. I was just like, oh my God, I need to rethink everything, especially when he was talking about, you know, I don't want to spoil the episode, but there's, you know, we're talking about things that comics have done that have helped them break out and get their achieve their fame. And then other people try to copy that or simulate it, and then it doesn't work. And it really opened up my eyes to, you know, social media and how every comic is trying to get videos out and things like that. And I'm one of them. The reason it really spoke with me is because I've been working tirelessly trying to put out videos. I've been doing one to two clips a day for the last like 2 weeks of stand-up clips that I've been putting on Instagram and TikTok. And I'm just like, well, maybe I should think of something different. You know, after this conversation that I had with Mike, it really made me think, well, maybe that's not the angle I should be going with. Maybe I shouldn't be trying to get, you know, TikTok or Instagram famous or whatever. You know, it is a necessary evil with comedy to have those things, but
it's necessary evil for sure. But, you know, he also says there's no way to shortcut it.
Absolutely.
There's no quick way. It's one of those art forms. It's not like acting and you're 11 years old and you're suddenly cast in a movie and that's your life now. That's not how it works in comedy.
Nope.
Everybody has to work to get better. And when you're good, you're good.
That's right. That's right. And that's, yeah, that's why, like I said, it's a great episode, a great conversation. I think we'll get into it real quick. Before we do that, just want to, you know, all the stuff, you know the drill. We go through this every episode. Make sure you're following us on social media, ArtofBombingPod. You can find all our social media links on our website, ArtofBombingPod.com. If you want to leave us a voicemail, you can go to podinbox.com/ArtofBombingPod. Scroll past the money thing and just hit the little microphone icon. Send us your message. We'd love to hear from you. We've got the Facebook group. Check that out. If you want to get involved in the community and talk about comedy and getting better, go join our Facebook group. All you got to do, search Art of Bombing Pod on Facebook. You'll find the page or you'll find the group. Join. We'd love to have you. And make sure you subscribe to the podcast and, you know, listen wherever you listen to podcasts. Make sure you're listening and subscribed. And then the most important way you can help this show grow and get more fan or more, you know, build our community is sharing the content that we put out. We're putting stuff out on YouTube. We've got our live broadcast. We just did one on last Tuesday. We just did Between Bombs where we talked about comedy festival video submissions. It was a great live stream. There's a lot of the community was watching and involved and chatting, and it was a good time. So we're doing stuff like that. Share that. All this stuff helps us get this show bigger, better, and hopefully everybody gets better, bigger, better, and grows together. And that's what we want. So check all that out. And I think, are we ready to get into this?
I am so ready for this episode, man.
All right. Gonna be fun. Here's our conversation with Mike. Enjoy.
And now it's time for the stand-up soundbite.
I got a roommate, you know, because I'm almost 50 and my life's going exactly how I planned it. Whatever, you don't remember being 14 and thinking, oh man, I hope when I'm 50 I live with another dude, man, I hope. Oh, fingers crossed. No homo or nothing, I'm just saying, like, you can go halvesies on the Bills. Share crockpot recipes.
Air fryer.
Just fucking yell out air fryer, sir. Is that? How long have you waited to just yell out your love of air fryers? Look, best case scenario, I go to a comedy club where a guy's talking about air fryers. That's the best case scenario. But look, if I go to a comedy show and he brings up crockpots, I'm fucking shoehorning it in. I'm yelling it out. That's close enough in my book. That's close enough in my book to share my love of air fryers with the rest of the world. Why would I hold back on my love of air fryers just because he's talking about crock pots? Yeah, it's not even the same thing, but you know what? You only live once. And I'm going to see a comedy show at the LA Comedy Club at the Stratosphere. And that's what you do. You just yell out your favorite cooking methods. Everybody knows that.
It's the art of bombing.
I don't know if you remember me. We actually worked together one time over in Minnesota at, what is it, Benton Station, I think is the name of it. The one outside of St. Cloud. Right before, it was like before the pandemic.
Yeah. I think I did New Year's there one time.
Okay. Well, I don't think this was New Year's, the weekend we were there, or the weekend we were there. Maybe it was. I don't remember, but it's been, maybe it was New Year's. I don't remember. It was a long time ago, though.
Yeah. I don't remember. I always mean, you know, don't feel bad if I don't remember, because it's like, it was just like a Thursday 5 years ago. I don't remember every fucking day, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
And I meet so many comics, like that's, it's my biggest fear when I meet people is like, have I already met you? And I'm just an ass and I don't remember, you know, it's terrible.
Well, I feel like that's a problem we all have as comics, because you do, you run into so many comedians traveling and working and everything. It is hard to keep track of people. And yeah. It's just, it's impossible. So I don't ever expect anybody to remember me.
Yeah, I'm always surprised when people remember me. I'm like, what? You fucking remember that? That's weird.
It was an interesting gig, because that radio DJ kind of hosted it. And they, it was weird, because they had like comedy in the back, and then there was a band that was following the comedy, but then they had like a band or karaoke up in the front of the bar. So there was like all these things going on simultaneously. And I was just like, wow, that's crazy. But
that's what comedy is, though.
Yeah, that's for sure. Definitely.
You just never know what you're going to get.
Yeah. Where were you this last weekend? Were you out on the road last weekend?
Yeah, I was at CG's. In Bolingbrook, Illinois. It's just outside of Chicago.
Oh, okay. Nice. And now you're based in Nashville now, right? Or are you, or do you go back and forth between Nashville and Wisconsin?
I was going back and forth between Nashville and Wisconsin, but now I only have a place in Wisconsin. I've stopped going to Nashville.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha. Yeah. It just, you know, I had another place down there and I wasn't there enough to justify having this other place. So I just gave it up. And plus, you know, with like what gas is now, I mean, I wouldn't be able to afford to, cause I always drive, but so I wouldn't be able to go back and forth anyway with how bad it is now. So.
No, absolutely. No, that definitely makes sense. But yeah, the gas prices now, it's ridiculous. I was just looking at some gigs that came through my email and you know, a lot of them, there's a lot of these gigs are like, oh, you get X amount of dollars and no lodging, but they give you extra money for the lodging, but the extra money's never enough. It doesn't cover what lodging actually is.
Dude, that's so, I think it's one of my biggest pet peeves in this business is people that offer gigs with no lodging. It bothers me to my core. It's like, you're already not paying us anything. Yep. The least you could do is give us a place to stay, you know?
Yeah. And
I've asked a few bookers about it before and they say, well, nobody wants to pay for lodging. Nobody. Well, then you guess what? You don't get to do comedy. I mean, that's part of the deal is you expect me to drive 6 hours to your place and then get my own hotel. Like, you know how much hotels cost and how much you're paying me? It's so disrespectful, dude. And I know exactly who you're talking about, too. Yeah. And all their gigs.
Yeah, and it's crazy because, like, you know, just with gas, like, everything's going up, too. You know, like you said, gas prices are going up, hotel, you know, airfare has gone up, you know.
Oh, yeah, so it's renting, like, it's renting a car. You rent a car now, it's ridiculous, so.
Yeah, if they have a car for you to rent, because there was a shortage for that for a while, too.
There's a guy named Chuck Johnson. He owns Summit Entertainment. And I think Chuck does mostly like college comics that do colleges. But he used to have a few one-nighters. But I remember this one time when we had like a gas crisis before and gas got crazy. He forced all of his gigs to chip in like an extra $50 for each comic per week just to make up for the gas prices. And then once he got those gigs up to that price, he never brought them back down. Once the gas thing went away. So He's a great dude, man. He's very comic friendly. I appreciate guys like that. Like,
yeah,
Chuck would never, he would never book a gig without a hotel. Like, he's a real, champion of this business. You know, some people support comics and some people don't give a shit. Some people, it's just, you know, their place is just a place to sell alcohol. You know, you just happen to be there selling. They don't give a shit about you. So,
oh, that happens. I feel like more times than not.
Oh yeah, they don't care at all.
You know, you always know it's going to be one of them gigs when you show up and they're like, "Oh, there's comedy tonight."
Yeah.
Nobody told me.
I was in Canada one time, and it was a weird week because the first show I did in Canada, I got a standing ovation. It like couldn't have been any better. Never got a standing ovation in my life. They made me do an encore, and I had already used all my material in the first set, so I just kind of like bullshitted for another 5 minutes, but amazing show. And then like two nights later, we're doing some bar in the middle of nowhere in Canada, some sports bar, and there's some sort of hockey thing happening on TV, and all the TVs are on. And I said to the guy, like, "Are you going to turn those TVs off before we do comedy?" He's like, "No. Everyone will leave if I turn those TVs off. What are you talking about?" I'm like, "Well, are you going to at least turn them down, you know, so I can do my show?" He's like, "No, everyone will leave if I turn them down." So I literally had to compete with this hockey game with a bunch of Canadians who didn't care that I was there. They didn't come to see comedy. It's like you said before. They're like, "What? There's comedy here?"
Yeah.
It was the worst, man. It was the worst. It was like 45 minutes of just – I was just reciting my act. I wasn't even – you know, I was putting nothing into it. I was just saying the words to get through it. It was crazy.
Yeah. Just to get to the end so you could collect the check or whatever. But I mean, as comics, that's not what we want. We perform because we love performing and, you know, we love writing and telling our jokes. I mean, I'm sure there are comics that just don't care. They'll just, you know, get through it or whatever. But it definitely takes the fun out of it when you have to do that, you know.
Whereas, yeah, because that's the reward. The reward is doing the show. And even if you didn't expect me, just a little simple common courtesy and of if you'd shut the fuck up while I talk, which would be nice. You know what I mean? Like, it's a common thing. It always amazes me that people think they can talk during comedy shows. Like, someone else is talking. What are you doing? That's like basic manners, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah. And I've seen so much of that in all the years I've been doing this. I've been heckled in every possible way. I honestly defend a lot of hecklers. I don't think they're malicious 99% of the time. I think people that yell stuff out, they don't realize that it's inappropriate, or they just can't help themselves. Or you're honestly, man, some comics are so good at being conversational that the crowd thinks they're talking right to them and they'll answer them. You know, they'll answer questions the comedian asks, but, you know, because they just forget, oh, shit, I'm in a public setting. I shouldn't be answering these questions. But
yeah, that's true. That's weird. True. Yeah. And I see that, too, because I've seen that with newer comics where they will ask questions and then either the audience will respond and they don't know how to react, or they're wanting the audience to respond and they don't respond. And like, you stop asking questions, make a statement, because it makes the show awkward.
You open yourself up. my buddy Mark, he knows he does it, but he asks questions all the time. And it's like, just do the bit. Don't ask him if they know what you're talking. Just do the bit. If they know what you're talking about, they'll laugh. But him, it's just, he does it so much in real life. And, you know, the goal when you're on stage is to be as conversational and as much like yourself as possible. So he talks like he would normally. So he would be like, you know what I'm talking about, right? He would reassure, you know, he'd need that reassurance in a conversation. So he gets on stage and he does the same thing, but it could be terrible because they might answer you. And then now you have a heckler that you invited to heckle you. And now the club doesn't know if they should tell that person to be quiet or not because you started it. So you put them in a weird spot too. And the audience thinks, well, it's okay for us to talk. He talked to that one guy. I guess I can talk.
Yeah. Yep. Definitely opens up that can of worms. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's an interesting point too, you made about the clubs. Cause there are some clubs that don't care regardless, you know, they don't keep talking or heckling down at all, but the ones that do, you're right. You definitely put them in a weird situation because they don't know what to do now. You know?
Yeah. I've had clubs where, you know, I'm having an interaction. It just happened this last week. I was having this interaction with this lady and it wasn't bad, though. She wasn't being malicious. She yelled something, and then I did a little back and forth with her. And then I see the manager of the club walk over and talk to her. And I was like, no, it's like, it's fine. You don't have to like reprimand her. It's fine. It's not aggressive. It's not egregious. They're not mm-hmm. trying to ruin the show. Like if they're trying to ruin the show, then by all means say something to them. But if we're having a nice back and forth, and listen, man, I don't want to toot my own horn, but I always win that argument. I'm going to win against any audience member. I've been doing this mm-hmm. almost 30 years. I'm wittier than you. I'm funnier than you. Plus my voice is amplified. I'm going to win. No one's ever won before. So when I work clubs and they say, well, how do we know when we should say something to an audience member? I say, you'll know, because it'll be so painfully obvious that it's, and I might just yell, get this son of a bitch out of here. You know?
It's, yeah.
Yeah. I like crowd work. So.
Yeah. I've seen that happen where, you know, the comic finally, I've seen comics have to ask people to leave or have the club kick people out. Cause they were just too, you know, just being too obnoxious. But then that's when you know it's really bad, when the comic on stage, because like you said, the comic is usually going to win, but when they just give up.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And some, my favorite is when I work Las Vegas, when I work for at the MGM Grand out there. And, you know, they don't mess around. They got four or five big, huge black dudes in the room in suits. And like you heckle once, you get a tap on the shoulder from these big dudes. You heckle twice, you're gone. So I love Vegas. I know the second somebody yells something at me, that's the only thing they're going to yell. Because as soon as those guys go to their table, they shut the fuck up. So, but you don't have that everywhere. You don't have that at the majority of clubs. They don't give a shit. They don't care.
Yeah. Yeah. Majority of clubs don't even have security people, really.
No.
I mean, obviously.
Yeah, when people are talking about all these comics getting attacked on stage, it's like, well, we're all vulnerable because I don't work clubs. I mean, if they can get to Chris Rock, or Dave Chappelle, and dude's got security, I'm fucked. Yeah, right. They're going to kill me, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm not worried about that. I'm not worried about anybody. People are trying to act like this is a new thing now. People are going to be attacking comedians. I say, come at me, bro. You come up on that stage. You know, I've because this happened, I've watched some videos of comedians being attacked on stage, and they never do anything. They just let the people attack them. Like, I dare you to come at me on stage. I'm going to kick your throat through your fucking neck. I can't understand why you wouldn't fight back. So many of these guys don't fight back.
Yeah, that is weird. Well, and the only thing that's new about comedians being attacked on stage is that it's happened on more of a worldwide platform. It's not new. Comedians have been attacked on stage. I've seen plenty of videos of comics getting attacked on stage. The only difference is it happened with celebrities and then like say on a bigger scale, you know, which now opens the door probably for more of it, but it's not like it's new.
No. And I don't think it's a big threat. And I don't think Chappelle thought it was a threat either. That's why he didn't press charges against that guy or maybe he did. I don't know. But I think he thought it wasn't a big deal.
I think he did. Maybe I haven't been following super close, but I've heard things here and there. And it sounded like the DA was the one that decided not to press felony charges and just charge the guy like a misdemeanor or something. But yeah, I don't know.
Well,
either way,
I think the truth from what I know is he tackled Dave. And then a minute later is when he pulled the gun knife thing out. It's when the guys were beating the shit out of him is when he pulled that out.
Oh, gotcha.
So I think maybe that because everyone's like, how is he not charged with attempted murder? And it's like, well, because he didn't even have the weapon out when he tackled him. So that his motive was not to kill Dave Chappelle or he would have had the weapon out, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's why they decided not. And honestly, man, the guy's out of his mind. He's crazy. You know, to run at somebody on stage, that's, you know, everyone's answer is, oh, throw him in jail. But it's like, no, let's figure out what's going on in that guy's head, because that's how guys like him turn into shooters. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mental illness is the whole problem. Why would a guy think it's okay to get on stage and do that, you know?
Yep. No, absolutely. You're absolutely right about that. We definitely have a problem in this country when it comes to like dealing with people with mental illness. It's easier to say it doesn't exist. We just don't. We just
straight up ignore it, pretend it's not a thing. And then every time something happens, we're like, we really need to do something about this mental illness. It's like, yeah, we do. But, you know, we used to have, you know, nut houses or whatever all over. There was places and they literally closed all those down. Like they closed all the insane asylum, all the places where we used to put these people and try to help them. And I just think with like how far we've come with like hallucinogenics and mushrooms and DMT and shit like that, I think you could probably start trying to fix some of those people now. Like, I believe the answer is not letting them live in their own shit in a tent on the street. The answer is, let's see if we can use some of these things to try to solve some of these problems, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
All the problems I see with this country, it's funny. I think about this all the time. Like, if I didn't have kids, I wouldn't give a shit about any of this. I'd be like, burn this bitch down. I'm out of here in 20 years. I don't care. I don't give a shit what happens. But as soon as you have kids, man, like, do you have kids?
I don't, no.
Yeah, it's a whole different, you're probably having a hard time giving a shit about a lot of things. But once you have a kid and you realize, oh shit, they have to live after I'm dead, like whatever happens with this world we live in, they have to live through that. It's terrifying, and it's terrifying right now with the social media and all that stuff. It's crazy, man. It's such a foreign thing.
Yeah. Well, and that's a good open-minded perspective too, to think about. Cause I don't think a lot of people do think about, I mean, obviously they don't, because if they did, we wouldn't be where we are necessarily. If more adults thought about what they'd be leaving the world for their kids, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just been progressively getting worse and worse and worse for each generation instead of better and better.
Well, I don't know how we're expected to keep this many people, you know, all like-minded in the first place. There's so many people. The fact that, I mean, knock on wood, you know, these tragedies are terrible when people go and shoot a bunch of people with guns, but I can't believe it doesn't happen every fucking day in this country. We have more guns than anyone else. Like, everyone's got a gun, but we get along pretty damn well in this country. Maybe that's because everybody does have a gun, but, you know, it's like, it's amazing how civil we really are, even in the world, you know. It's amazing how civil we are, considering we could just go crazy on each other.
Yeah, it could just be savages.
So it's not as bad as it could be, but, you know, I worry, man. I worry a lot about, like, if we lost power, like electricity, in even 25% of this country, within 2 weeks, it would be a fucking nut house. People would be killing each other for food. It would be a nightmare.
Absolutely.
And you don't have a phone. You don't have any way to communicate. All that's going to work now is CB radio. So truckers are the only ones. Truckers and cops will be able to communicate. We'd be screwed, man. Without that refrigerator in that other room, I'm not going to live very long, dude. I don't know how to hunt. I don't know how to do any of that stuff. It's terrifying. Yep.
It is. And it's crazy too, because you see all these like TV shows and movies that come out, and it's like, oh man, these are starting to turn into prophecies, not entertainment.
Well, when you think about the fact that, and I don't know anything about like really anything at all, but we're the longest running democracy that's ever existed. The fact that we made it this long is really impressive. We could easily turn into a third world country. Like I said, you take electricity away, you take something away for any extended period of time, and we're going to revert, man. We'll all go back to being fucking savages. And
we get a little
cocky, and we think, oh, we're America. And I'm guilty of it. Like, my whole life, I'm like, yeah, we're safe, we're good. And then like 9/11 happened, and everyone went, oh shit. Like, maybe we shouldn't be so cocky. Like, they can fuck with us. They can hit us, you know? But we really do just act like, oh, everything will be fine. Everything will work its way out. But it's terrifying, man. It's terrifying.
No, absolutely. I agree with that. Even though, like I said, I don't have kids, but I'm still terrified of the way the things are going to be. I mean, I don't have my own kids, but I have nieces, nephews, you know, brothers, sisters, all that jazz. So I worry about that. You know, it's very terrifying. Just like bombing and comedy is terrifying. So I'm going to transition to that.
All right.
I'm going to transition over to that, because I always love to hear stories from the comics on the show about a time where they felt like they bombed or they had a really bad show and kind of what happened. So I would love to hear a story from you.
Well, I already gave you the one about Canada. That was a pretty good one.
Yeah.
one of the ones that was, I guess, the most eye-opening for me, because I sort of developed a style where if it's not going well, I acknowledge it. You know, I'll mention, wow, I'm bombing. Like, I'll say, this is going terrible. I'll call out the elephant in the room. And I remember when I started, all these other comedians would tell me, don't do that, man. If the joke doesn't work, you just plow through, you go to the next joke, you try the next one. Don't acknowledge that it didn't work. And I'm like, well, why would I do that? Because they all know it didn't work. You know, I threw it out like it was a joke. I almost waited for them to laugh and they didn't. So they know I was why not call out the obvious? So I would always do it. And it was very self-deprecating and, you know, it's cheating, but it was a way to get another, you would end up getting a laugh at talking about how crappy that previous joke was. So I ended up developing sort of that skill. But when I started doing comedy, I started at the club here in Appleton, Wisconsin. And I never did open mics, man. I got so lucky. I did one open mic in Milwaukee on a Thursday after doing a show at the club, a sold out 250 person show. I go down to the open mic and of course it's six other comedians and that's it. And I bombed and ate shit. And I was like, why would you ever do this? So I give comedians, most normal comedians that came up through the open mics, I give you guys all the credit in the world because you knew how to bomb because you started out bombing. I didn't start out bombing. I started out doing okay because there was 300 people in the room every night. This is in the 90s when it was still, people gave a shit about comedy. So, I mean, I practiced in front of a full house every night. So I got cocky, man. I thought I was a really, after 2 years, I was like, I'm fucking good at this, man.
I have to know. I'm curious. How did you manage to bypass the open mic system?
Well, the club opens up here in Appleton, Wisconsin. There's no other comedy clubs. The closest one is Milwaukee. And my buddy he starts out there as a doorman and then gets hired to manage the place. And when he got hired to manage, he gets a hold of me. He goes, hey, you should come down here and just be a doorman. Like, it's super easy. And remember, the club's packed every fucking show. So it's sold out. It's great. Yeah. Like, it's the hopping thing to do. So I was like, hell yeah, man, I'll come down there. You know, huge fan of comedy when I was a kid. That the big boom on TV in the 80s was my jam. I watched all of it. You know, I'd stay up late and watch every single stand-up show I could find. And so I just started working at the club. And just a bunch of comics were telling me, they're like, why don't you do comedy? Like, you're funny and you fucking work at a club. Like, why aren't you doing it? And, you know, secretly I always wanted to do it, but I was scared, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, my buddy just ends up, he lets me host a show one night. And then there was no open mics anywhere. I was literally the only comedian in Appleton, Wisconsin.
Oh, wow.
My buddy Rob Brackenridge is from here as well. And he's back here now. But at the time, he was living in L.A. He did 20 years in L.A., you know, acting and all that stuff. So I was the only comedian. There's nowhere for me to go up. So my buddy just let me do guest sets on shows. I would just do, hey, we got a special guest. And it would be my mumbling, horrible comedy. You know, when I think back of it, I owe this guy so much. His name's Cliff. And I owe him so much for letting me do that because I was so bad. But he would let me go up in front of these full audiences that paid money to see real comedy. I don't know what he was thinking, but...
Well, so I saw something in you, because that's a good way to develop too.
Yeah, I guess
you get a better sense of what's working and what isn't when you're in front of a real crowd.
I think you get I got so much sympathy. Like, people just felt bad for me because I was terrible. And, you know, I've heard the statistic one time that it's like 1 in 3 people are going to like you out of in any audience. So if there's 300 people there and you make 100 of them laugh, that's going to sound pretty good. It's going to sound like you're doing okay, even though only 1 in 3 liked you. And some other people might laugh because laughter truly is contagious, but you're not going to get a lot. So anyway, I just, for 2 years, I did that. I did sets, and then like he'd give me like a feature week, you know, where I'd do 25 minutes in the middle. And man, it was probably 2-3 years. I thought I was just the best. And, I got this gig in Altus, Oklahoma, and this guy out of nowhere gets a hold of me named C.W. Kendall. I don't know if he's still booking gigs. I don't know if he's alive. If he's not, R.I.P. But and he was some like famous guitarist from back in the day from some band. I don't know. Anyway, he gives me this gig, and there's no way he was headlining me, and there's no way I should have been headlining. Like, I had maybe, if I'm being honest, 30 minutes worth of material. But, you know, somebody at that stage is like, I'll give you $300 to come all the way to fucking Oklahoma. And I was like, oh, that sounds like a good idea. So I went. And I'm telling you, bro, I got there and it's literally just a bar. It's just a regular bar. There's no stage. They go, we'll probably just have you stand in the corner over there. And I was like, fucking what? Like, there's no stage. There's no lights, you know? And they had a PA system, but it was terrible. And like, it's getting closer and closer to showtime, and there's only like 9 people in there. And they're all like cowboys, dude, like cowboy hats. And not like when you normally see people in cowboy hats, it's just people wearing a cowboy costume. They're dressed. These dudes were legit cowboys. Like they had.
Yeah, you were in Oklahoma. That's right.
Yeah. They were like legit in the fields, like wrangling cattle and everything before they came to the show. They didn't know there was a show going on, and they did not give a shit that there was a show going on. These 9 dudes, I had to do a show. I had to do like, I was supposed to do like an hour. And I got like 25 minutes worth of material. And I remember the opener just bombed, just ate shit, didn't get any laughs. And I'm like, and if I'm being 100% honest, the opener is a way better comic than me. I shouldn't even be headlining. So I'm watching someone who's way better than me in the middle spot do way better than I'm going to. Right? At least he has a chance. He seems like a better comic than me. I wish I could remember who that comic was, but yeah, dude, then I went up there and I got nothing, man. And I was just, I got nothing. Like all this stuff that I think works, all the stuff that I thought worked, like I didn't realize really until the ride there how much of my stuff was local and not even going to work in Oklahoma. Like so much of it was, it's not like necessarily all about Wisconsin, but a lot of it was like Midwest stuff that they're not going to relate to. So I'm panicking, and it was the long. I don't think I did. I probably did. If I did 40 minutes, I'd be surprised, because I was just flop sweating, and I was every joke I could think of. I was mad I didn't bring my notebook up, because I could at least maybe open my notebook and found something different. But I was just, I was panicking, dude. I was flop sweating hard. It was the worst. But you know, I made it through, and nobody said anything. The bartender was like, oh, well, hopefully next time we'll have a crowd. Like, she blamed it on the audience, even though I was terrible.
But, well, that was nice of her.
That was very nice of her. She's like, oh, yeah, I don't know. What's up with these 9 guys who wanted you dead? Like, yeah, they just didn't care at all. And but, you know, it taught me that lesson, man. It taught me that, wow, I'm not as good as I thought I am. Turns out I'm garbage, because I should be able to survive. You know, now I know 27 years later that you can have just as fun of a show with 9 people. Well, not just as fun, but you can make a show with 9 people fun.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Absolutely.
Like, I worked with this other comic friend of mine once, and we did, I took him to these gigs in northern Wisconsin and Michigan, and they're horrible bowling alley gigs, one of them. And there's like 7 people there, and they're spread out through the whole bowling alley. And he just, my buddy ate all the dicks in the world. Just, it was terrible. And, we're driving back, and he goes, man, I don't like doing shows for like 7 people. I prefer doing like sold out, you know, Funny Bones and improvs. And I was like, yeah, fucking yeah, we all like that. Like, talk about the most obvious thing in the world to say. Yes, of course, we all like it when there's more people that give a shit. But this is what comedy is a lot of times, until you become a name and people come to see you on purpose. This is what it is. You just don't know what the audience is going to be. You don't know what. You don't know what kind of lunatics they're going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's all part of, it's all part of the process. That's one thing I find fascinating about comedy, is that, you know, it is a process. It's a long process. But the cool thing is everybody has their own path. Like, we're not, there's not one right or wrong way that you have to do comedy. I mean, obviously there's things that'll help you or hinder you, but for the most part, you know, you're in control of how far you go or don't go. You know, and that's one thing that's great about it.
Well, that it's, you're self-employed. That's what I always liked about it. I'm my own boss. And then you can do your best. There's only so much you can do in the business, but you know, it's up to you how good you get. Like, I always tell young comics when I work cities and like I'll go to open mics and stuff, and there's comics that don't come and watch the shows. They don't watch the professional headliners and features and stuff. And I think that's a huge mistake. I mean, when I was the doorman at that comedy club, I watched every show. And I was like, all right, let me see how this Wednesday show is. And then I'll be like, okay, it's Thursday. And they had a day to get loose, that first show. Let's see how they handle Saturday, Friday, you know. And then Friday late show is notoriously bad. Let's see if that happens. Let's see how these two comedians deal with it. And, you know, I'd watch guys create bits throughout the week. Like on a Wednesday or Thursday, they just throw something at the wall. And then by Saturday night, it's a killer bit. You know, I learned so much by watching other comics do it. And, you know, there's scenes out there that I've been to where they have a really good comedy club and there's no young comics there. Like, you should be there just observing. It doesn't matter if you hate the comic. Like, you could think this comic sucks. You can think what they do is bullshit. Yep. But if they're working the A room in town, they must have done something. So you're doing yourself a disservice by not at least just watching them. Just watch
yep.
them. You
no,
know,
absolutely.
And see how they change things. And, you know, you just put that in your head. Okay, that's right. I saw that one guy really had to ramp it up that show because this, you know, and you just kind of, you're not stealing things. You're not stealing material, obviously, but you're figuring out how stand-up works, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
But Tom Clark has the best joke ever where he goes, stand-up comedy is a lot like having sex. You learn it by watching other people. Which is a really funny joke that he does way better than I just did, but yeah,
that is a funny, but that is really funny. It's true though, it really is.
You have to put in the work though, man. I think, you know, when you say there's no right way and no wrong way, I think for me to respect you, you got to put the work in. You got to sleep in your car. You gotta go halfway across the country for $125. Like, I think those are the things that really built me as a comic. I had a minivan for years and I would just stay in the minivan on off nights. And I would just try to book like a month, 2 months straight gigs all around the country, garbage paying gigs, you know, but I had no overhead. I didn't really need the money. Like, if you need to make money, this is not the business for you.
Oh, absolutely.
And I do also feel that you need to lean into it full force. Like, you, I was taking comedy seriously, but I had a part-time job. I was working at an auto dealership and I worked at parts stores and stuff. And then just one day I realized, like, man, if you're going to do this for reals, you got to quit everything. This has to be the only way you make money. And you're going to make crap money in the beginning, but that's what's going to motivate you to get better, to get to that feature spot, and then to work harder and get to that headliner spot so you can make more money. And that's what I did, you know. And unfortunately, it took me 20 years to get to the headliner spot. And in that 20 years, the pay didn't increase at all. So by the time I finally got up there, it wasn't shit money. Cause when I started, it was like, you can make like $800,000 a week being a headliner. Like, dude, when I was young, I was like, I could fucking live off that. You know,
20 years ago,
you're balling. Now yep. that's not that much money, man. And
no.
you have to pay taxes on all that. We're talking, this is all pre-tax. I mean, you got to really want to do comedy. And I think too many people, and it is what it is, but a lot of people get to shortcut it now because they have a podcast or they get a viral video or all of a sudden they're big on TikTok, whatever the fuck that means. Like, just being big on TikTok, like, you get to be a star now. It's so baffling to me, you know. I don't want to sound like the old guy, but it's too much sometimes, you know.
It is. And you see that, I mean, especially when it comes to social media and like TikTok or YouTube becoming famous like that, it's one of them deals where, yeah, it is a shortcut. But at the same time, you can say, well, if they have fans that are coming to see them, I guess I get it. There's that.
I mean, they got
that drawability.
it is. But if you're a comic and you get too big too soon, I think you do yourself a disservice. Like, I had people that, comics that I started out with that had like big pops early, got real big early, and all those guys have day jobs now.
Yeah,
like they kind of like, because they didn't really, I don't know, I feel like you need a long time to marinate in this business. Like, Bill Burr didn't get famous until he'd been doing it 20 years, you know. Lewis Black, all, just name the comic, Robert Kelly, like all these guys,
absolutely,
they all did it for 15, 20 years before anyone gave a shit, and that's just part of it.
Yeah.
You know, but not necessarily anymore, because you have a funny viral video or a funny take on a thing and it's timely, and it's weird. I heard Judah Friedlander say recently that it used to be that in the entertainment business, it was about quality. And at some point it became about quantity. It became about, oh, you have 100 million views on that video. Well, then we should support you. You're worth making money. You should be rich. It used to be, this is really quality. Like, you put out a lot of bullshit, that's one thing. But if you put out one quality thing, it used to matter, and it kind of doesn't anymore. It was a really brilliant point that he brought up. Quantity is now the thing. Quantity is like, how many followers do you have? How many views on YouTube? How many this and that? And it's like, well, I just wanted to be a comedian. I didn't sign up to be a fucking social media mogul. Like, I just wanted to tell jokes, and, you know, so, but.
Yeah. I hear that. It's exhausting too, as someone that's like in the middle, you know, like I'm in the middle of, you know, the generations before me, they're not really into the social media. Generations after me are more into social media. So I'm like right in the middle of, you know, leaning either way.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I try to keep up, but at the same time, I'm like, this is too exhausting. I don't know how these kids can do it.
Yeah, I don't know. I watch other comedians do it, and I just don't understand. Like, how do you have time to be editing all of these videos? And I don't know, man. Here's another theory I have, and I'm just flapping my gums, but we got to stop doing things that work for other comedians, because it started with Dane Cook when he figured out MySpace. Mm-hmm. When Dane Cook figured out MySpace, all of us, including myself, everyone just ran to MySpace. And then we all gossiped, like, what did Dane do? How did he do it? And we all did the exact same thing Dane did. And it worked for how many of us? Zero. Okay? There's a lot of people out there trying to be Joe Rogan right now with their podcast. It's not going to happen. There's one Joe Rogan. You might be able to take a little piece of that. But as soon as Joe Rogan made something big with that, everyone runs out and starts a podcast. Actually, that started with Marc Maron. I'll give Marc Maron credit on that. I feel like he was big before Rogan was. But it's like, and then, you know, Andrew Schultz comes through and he's really good at crowd work. Like, this guy's really good at the crowd work and becomes huge. Like, he's selling out fucking stadiums and shit. So every other comic out there, now I got to put up crowd work videos. That's the new thing. I got to put up crowd work videos. Who else has become famous from crowd work videos? Nobody. We got to stop doing the same things that other comedians are doing. It seems obvious. And that's where my thing is with the social media is like, hey, everybody else is doing that. I don't want to glom onto it and be like, oh, I'm going to make Instagram work for me too. You know, it's almost like, I don't know. I feel like, you know, the social media is sort of the necessary evil, but I don't know. I want to find that one thing that nobody's doing that one route that nobody's taking. And because those are official ways to become famous. I don't think, you know, viral videos, I don't think that should count as much.
Yeah. In the grand scheme. It seems like kind of, and it, even like with viral videos, it seems more short, like short term fame. You know, it's like the 15 minutes of fame. Like, you know, you get it, but how long does that last? You know, how long before you're back to where you were before?
And that's why I think it's important to put in that time doing comedy. You need that 15-20 years. So when it does happen, if and when it does happen, you're ready for it. Like, if I got all of a sudden got famous, you know, tomorrow, and let's say I all of a sudden in the next 3 months I hit Tom Segura level, I got a fucking tour bus out in front of my house, I'm making $750,000 a week doing stand up, I could do it. I could do show. I could do an hour and a half in front of a stadium right now. I got that kind of material. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But if I would have got big 10 years ago, there's no fucking way I could have done it. There's no way I could have done anything like that. So, like, I wasn't ready for it. So now I'm ready for it. And, you know, it might not happen, but it is what it is. At least I'm ready for it if it happens. You know?
Yeah. Well, and it could happen. I mean, because that is the thing, you know, with comedy, like you said, a lot of these people that end up becoming mega stars, when they broke out, they'd been doing comedy forever. They weren't new to any hardcore, you know, comedy fan or comedy nerd or other people in the business knew these people. You know, they're not just a sudden overnight success. Like you said, it was 20 years of busting their butt.
Right. Yeah, there are no real overnight successes in comedy. Everybody worked for it, you know?
Yep.
But then we all hope to get like that. I mean, everybody would love to get that Russell Peters thing where you just a certain segment of the population that happens to be a huge population, the Indian population, embrace that guy at a time where YouTube was new and the stars aligned, and all of a sudden he's like the biggest comic in the world, you know, and we all are like, how can we make that happen? You can't make it happen. You can't make yourself become famous. You can't make people give a shit about you. You have to, from what I can tell, you have to stop giving a shit. You have to stop trying to make it. You have to stop trying to get people to pay attention to you. And that seems to be when it happens. But it's real hard for us all to step back and go, you know what? I don't give a shit if anybody pays attention to me, because that's why we started doing it in the first place. We're comedians. I want people to pay attention. Not enough people paid attention to me growing up, so I seek that attention from strangers. And not that it's for them either. I always make a point of pointing this out. I don't do comedy for the people in that audience. I mean, it's great that I've cheered people up. I've helped people, you know, up their level of endorphins. I made them forget their problems for an hour, whatever it may be. I'm really happy all that stuff happened, but I do it for me, man. I do it for my own endorphin rush. I do it for, I'm in control when I'm up there, you know? So I don't do it for the audience. So that's why that's ultimately, you know, when you bomb, that's why I never really cared when I did bomb in the beginning, because I was like, it's not about you guys anyway. You know, yeah. I can't even remember the other comedian I worked with when I bombed, let alone the people in the audience. Like, I don't know those people. So I've always approached it as though the audience, they matter, but they also don't matter at all. So if a group of them don't like you one night, it is what it is.
Yeah, no, and that's a good point. I mean, that is definitely a good way to not get hung up on it, because a lot of comedians do get hung up on bad shows, you know, because it's easy to, you know, that dread to just kind of hover with us forever. So having a way to let it go is, I feel like it's very healthy, because it's easy to get caught up in that, you know. And even I've been guilty of that, especially when I was a newer comic. Now, not so much. If I bomb, it's going to happen. And I also, you know, there's different types of, you know, bombing. You know, if I'm at an open mic and I have certain goals that I'm trying to accomplish, if I accomplish those goals and it ain't a great set, that's not a bomb. That's me working some shit out. But if I go, you know, I'm getting paid to do like a corporate gig and I eat it for an hour and then I have to go ask for a check, you know, those are the ones that hit hard. Yeah. It's like, well, now I have to go try to get paid after that atrocity that they just witnessed.
Those are the worst, man. And, you know, I'd be willing to say that, because we all talk about corporates and how bad they are, and they usually are. They're in some sterile, you know, conference room with the PA system, with the speakers in the ceiling. I mean, everyone works together. They don't want to laugh at things. It's just literally the worst setup in the world for stand-up comedy, but they pay the most. And the way my friend Rob and I talk about it, like, that's why you should always ask for a lot of money for corporates, because they're paying you to be uncomfortable. Remember, I said, this is all about me. This is all about me, and I want to have fun. So if you want me to have fun in that situation, the only fun I have is knowing that you're giving me a big check after that show. The only reason I can get through it and tolerate it. Because if I'm not doing that for $300, I'm not going to bomb. I'm not going to take a gig I know is going to suck, you know, for $300. It's just not going to happen. But so that's why it's weird, because you do those corporates and everything sounds good when you book it. And then the day comes and you're like, oh, this is going to be terrible. I just know it's going to suck. You know, it's going to be the worst. But
that's all part of it. Now, over the years, you've been doing comedy for a long time. What do you do, like, and maybe early on, especially early on, what did you do to like try to analyze your sets, to try to, like, if you had a bad show or you bombed, to try to figure out what you could do in the next situation to prevent it?
God, I really don't want this to sound cocky, but I didn't really bomb much. I wouldn't allow it to happen, man. When it started happening, like, there's this thing that most comics don't do, is you do not, nobody connects with that audience. Nobody connects with the audience. Not nobody, obviously. The good comics do, like the real successful ones, the really good comics, they literally connect with that audience. You're talking directly to that audience. So many comics, young comics, go up there and they're reciting their jokes. The audience can tell it's rehearsed. It doesn't sound conversational. Bill Burr sounds conversational. Lewis Black sounds conversational. Chappelle, holy shit. Chappelle is the most conversational guy in the world. Comics go up there and we try to rush. We dive head first. Like, no, let me say a whole bunch of words and get to the part. This is gonna be funny. Oh, they didn't laugh. Oh, shit. Let me get a whole bunch of words out and let me get the other part. This is going to be funny. Oh, they didn't laugh. Let me hurry up. Like, you got to just, somebody said once, like, slowing down is the key, and it truly is. And that's even when you start, too. Don't just go up and be so eager. And actually look at the audience and find some little thing in the room or some little thing about the comic before you that you can say, just one thing, so not everything that comes out of your mouth is rehearsed. You know what I mean? They want to feel like you're a real dude. Like so many of us, I did it for years. And when you're not passionate about it, you lose faith in a joke and you've done it a million times. You don't deliver it with the same passion. So it starts to sound rehearsed. And as dumb as audiences are, because all we're tricking them, all comedy is tricking them, they can tell when you're nervous. They can tell when it's pre-rehearsed. They can tell when it's bullshit. And so you have to, even though you're nervous, even though all of those things are true, you have to put it out there in a way where they can't tell that. And I always point to Doug Stanhope. Doug Stanhope is the best I've ever seen do it. Like, he changed the way I did comedy. I saw him in Minneapolis at Acme, and he murdered for like an hour. And as far as I could tell, dude, he was making it all up. I was like, this guy is just like funny to his core. He didn't even really have jokes. Like, everyone else has like setups and punchlines, but this guy, like, he was just talking. It was funny. Like, my mind was blown. I was literally 6 months into comedy, or maybe a year. So like a year later, he comes and works my home club in Appleton. And about 10 minutes in, I realize, holy fuck, he's doing that on purpose. Like, he's doing the same jokes. It's all the exact same jokes with the same pacing, the same pausing, the same stutters, the same, oh, I can't think about what I'm going to say. Like, those little 0.3 second pauses where he's trying to think about what he's going to, he knows what he's going to fucking say. He wrote that shit word for word. But the way he delivers it is as though it's just a conversation and he's literally talking right to them. And I'll go on record and say I blatantly stole that from Doug Stanhope. I saw how he did that, and I was like, that's the way to do it, because they shouldn't be able to tell you're doing comedy. Steve Byrne is another guy I've seen do it. Mm-hmm. Steve Byrne will go up and do 20 minutes of crowd work. You know, he's not doing material. You're like, the second you go up, you just jump into material, like audiences can tell. I don't know why I started blabbering on about this, but.
Oh, because I was asking you about analyzing situations and how you can, but that goes, I mean, that was a good point, because you're talking about analyzing other comics and figuring out, you know, how to avoid bombing, because making that connection with an audience.
Yeah, because then they want to, they believe you're doing it specifically for them. Like, it's a real personal thing, man. You're expecting other human beings to sit there quietly and listen to what you have to say. And a lot of us get arrogant about, oh, who could, this crowd's not listening. They don't like you. That's why they're not listening. They don't like you. Something about you is off-putting. You didn't connect with them. You got up there, and some of them feel like you're talking down to them because you didn't appropriately, you know what I'm saying? There needs to be this little moment where you melt into that audience and become one of with them. And honestly, man, I shouldn't say the secret to my success, because I'm not really successful, but it's the way I do comedy, because it's the way we're talking right now. The way we're talking right now is off the cuff. And if I happen to accidentally say something funny, I mean, that's what it should look like on stage. You know, the idea that you have to be robotic and, you know, Dimitri Martin, he's a different guy. Like, he's writing real jokes. That guy's writing real jokes. A lot of us aren't writing real jokes, you know. Who's the other one? Mark Norman. Mark Norman's writing. What the brilliance of Mark Norman is, this is the secret to why Mark Norman is so fucking lovable and so good, is that he's got that conversational thing that we're talking about, where that audience feels like he's talking directly to them. But he's also doing really well-written jokes. Like, I've got the, hey, they feel like I'm talking to them part down with all the horse shit I spew at them to trick them into laughing. He's doing that with real good jokes. Like, that's what makes him so amazing, is it feels he disguises his bits that you clearly know are bits as conversational. It's amazing. Where like you watch Seinfeld, you know it's a bit. Mm-hmm. You know it's a bit. Like, it's not a bad thing, because you still like it. It's still funny at the end, but you know it's a bit. Like, the best ones out there just seem like they're just talking. Seems simple, but it's the hardest thing in the world to do, because you're fucking terrified. You're terrified when you're up there.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. And like, you have to get that likability too, because that's, you know, the connection starts with them liking you.
Yeah. And you know, I've always heard they decide in the first 15 seconds and not whether they like you or not. So a lot of times, before you've even said a word, they already got an idea of whether or not they're going to like you, whether or not you're going to be funny. The way you walk on stage, like the way you set your glass down, like, we read other people. We do it all the time with people. We read people constantly. And so that audience is reading you. So you have to, if you're not confident, you at least have to be able to act confident. That's why I think a lot of the best comics end up being really good actors too, is because they've had to act confident in so many situations where they're not. Like, I'm fucking terrified sometimes doing comedy. You know, I'll be 35 minutes into an hour set and be like, fuck, I can't even think of any other jokes. Like, it's life or death, you know, but luckily I have enough skills and enough tools that I can get through it. But again, to come full circle, that's why you got to put in that time on the road. You don't develop these kind of, you can't just take a welding class and go out and get a job as a welder tomorrow. You have to be like an apprentice. Yep. You have to practice. You have to, you know, they're not going to hire you if you can't weld. You know, you can't just, that's the problem with saying you're a comedian too early, which I think as soon as you devote your life to this, you're a comedian. But there is a problem with saying that too early, because then you get hired for things that you can't do, you know?
Yeah.
It's important to be a realist about what you can and can't do as a comic. But it's also important to stick your nose out.
I was just agreeing. I think that's super important. That being self-aware is huge.
There seems to be this thing, man. I've met so many comics that, like, they'll even to this day, man, when people tell me, like, hey, great set or this or that, I'm like, ah, man, you know, like, fucking fucked up that one thing. You know, like, I'm never like, yeah, it was a great set. I did great. Like, I hate everything I do to this day. Like, I can't listen to myself. I think everything I do is garbage. I'm exposed to a lot of stand-up comedy, so I've heard a lot of stand-up comedy, and what I do is garbage. What I do has been done by thousands of comedians before. There's nothing unique about me, you know, but I have that awareness. I have that awareness of I'm not really breaking any new ground. You know, I'm not doing anything different than anybody else has done. I feel maybe that's too negative about myself, but.
No, I mean, it's definitely being self-aware, being, you know, real. I mean, probably hypercritical. There's definitely
flip side is thinking, oh, I'm fucking great. How come I'm not famous? How come I don't have a tour bus? Dude, I'm fucking better than that comic. I'm better than that guy. I mean, that's the alternative, and I don't want to be that guy because I'm not that guy. I have to be reasonable and go, you know what? Look, the masses, you know, and so much of it is luck anyway, so you can always throw it off on that. You know, for not being like huge at any point in your career, because a lot of it really is luck and time and place and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. But, definitely a lot of variables.
Yeah.
In there. Well, we're going to start wrapping up. We talk about bombing, so I like to do more positive stuff at the end. I got a couple things we'll go through, and then we're going to talk about, you got a new thing coming out, but we'll talk about that here in a few. I have a playlist for songs that get you pumped up. It doesn't have to be specifically that gets you pumped up to do comedy, but just in general, is there a song that you have that pumps you up?
Oh, I always hate answering music questions because I'm a Dave Matthews Band fan, man. I've been a Dave Matthews fan since 92. I saw him the first time. I've seen him over 30 times in concert. I love them. They're great. They're a band that I've loved watching the evolution of the band, what they were, you know, back then and to now. So there's certain songs like Jimmy Thing. I'll always listen to Jimmy Thing because they always have a nice jam in there. I'll listen to ones with guest players on it. So I listen to a lot of different Dave Matthews, which seems cheesy, but.
Nothing wrong with liking what you like.
I mean, you know, it just gets me in the mind because honestly, man, I wish I had the career of Dave Matthews. And this is, I've always wanted to have the kind of career that they did, but in comedy with, and sort of like the Brian Regan thing as well, because Brian Regan never did any television or anything. He's just built fans organically. And that's kind of how Dave Matthews did it. They built fans organically. That's how they became a band in the first place, you know? And I've watched their evolution, and their whole thing is like, you don't see a lot of interviews with them. You don't see them branching out and doing a bunch of other things. They just play. They just play, and they're the top grossing touring band, I think, of all time. Like, they tour more than anyone. Like, they're constantly touring because to them, it's all about the live performance. So I think about my career like theirs as well. Like I'm building too, you know, and when I started, I had a certain skill set, and over the years I've added to that. And, you know, you listen to Dave's voice now compared to what it sounded like 25 years ago. A lot of the criticism they got is that he was whiny and this and that. Well, he's 23 years old. he has a man's voice now. It sounds a little different. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and the same with my comedy. You know, I did radio in the beginning of my career and I sounded like a 13-year-old girl. And now I think I sound like a man. So, but so my, I look at my career like theirs as well, except I haven't been successful. But the idea
you're still
of
just doing keep, it. Keep, I mean, that's not
craft.
For nothing.
Right. That's true. That's true. But I really feel like, and I also feel to this day, almost 30 years in, that every time I do stand up, dude, I get a little teeny weeny, teeny tiny bit better every time. So why would I stop doing it? I want to see how good I can get at this. Like if I keep feel like I keep getting better and my material gets better and everything about it gets better, there's no reason to ever stop. Like there's some comedians that plateau. They get to a certain level and you're like, okay, I think that's as far as that guy's ever going to go. I feel like I'm still evolving and still getting better. So that's what keeps me doing it, I guess. Is it, who knows what could happen, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, the couple more things, like I said, we talk about bad gigs. I always love, cause there's, you know, so many gigs out there, you know, it seems like we always remember those bad ones cause they stick with us, but I like to hear about a favorite gig, you know, someone like you that's been doing comedy for 30 years. I'm sure you have a lot of gigs that have been good and stuff, but do you have a gig that just really stood out for you in your career? personally?
Yeah. Probably the best one I ever did that I always think of when anybody ever asks that question, I think of this, is I was doing the San Francisco comedy competition. And I don't know, we were like 2 weeks into it. You do a whole bunch of shows and you do all kinds of different venues. Like one night it'll be a comedy club. The next night it's a coffee bar. The next night it's a big theater. And we were at the Wells Fargo Center in Oregon, somewhere there. And it was 1600 people. It was three levels of seating. All sold out, and I had an amazing set, like one of the best sets I've ever had. Like I swear I could feel wind from the laughter from all the people. Like I could feel pulses of energy with every laugh. It's the craziest show I've ever done. I think I didn't do well the night before in the competition, and the idea is they accumulate points, and anyway, it's a whole thing, but
yeah, it's a process.
I really wanted to do well that night, and that audience was just amazing, and it was electric, and I won that night because they have a winner each night, so I got first place that night. And that's when I was like, this is what Tom Segura feels every night. This is what, you know, this is before Tom was obviously even as big as he is, but you know, I'm like, this is what real comedians feel every night, you know, 1600 people that fucking are rooting for you and they like you and they want you to succeed. And you know, because you don't always get that in comedy. Sometimes it's nine drunk cowboys at a bar in Altus, Oklahoma.
That just came for a drink.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hear that. Well, the last thing we do is we play a little game called Pick a Number. You're going to pick a number between 1 and 20, ask you a corresponding question. It may or may not be related to comedy.
17.
All right. Well, this is a good one. If you could make a difference in the world, what would you be known for? What would that difference be?
Man, if somebody could figure out that homeless mental illness thing, I mean, there's no chance I could do that. But I don't know. The only thing, look, man, I don't want to be a sappy douche or whatever, but I got an 11 and a 15-year-old boy. And they've seen me do comedy now a few times. I've taken them on the road the last few gigs that I could. Mm-hmm. And they've both said to me multiple times, like, oh, my God, Dad, like, you're really funny. Like, you're really good at comedy. And that's making a change in the world, then I'll take that. But that's that's the thing that's made me feel the best is just them liking what I do. I'm still not their favorite comedian, but, you know. But for them to just acknowledge that I'm good. And it's sort of like society has treated me. Like they acknowledge, yeah, you're pretty decent, but you're not our favorite guy. So my kids treat me the same way that the world has so far.
Oh, that's great. Well, now we're wrapping up here. You've got a great special coming out. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's called the Stand Up Journeyman. And it's myself, Johnny Beaner, Mike Stanley, and Rob Breckenridge. It's episodic, as they say in the business. So there's the four episodes, and it's really fun. We filmed it at big theater in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And it comes out May 19th. And it'll be on YouTube on 800 Pound Gorilla Records YouTube page. And all of the proceeds, we're going to give all of the money that we make on YouTube to the Children's Hospital of Milwaukee, or I'm sorry, of Madison. Or maybe, I think there's a general charity for all of them in Wisconsin. Yeah. But fuck the ones in the other states. We don't care about that.
We only care about Wisconsin.
But we really only care about Wisconsin.
I assume it's because all of the comics, you're all from Wisconsin?
No, actually, we're journeyman comics. I mean, that's the idea of the special, is we're all just journeymen. It's this conversation we've been having this whole thing. It's like, yeah, I can do the job, but I'm not famous. Like, they used to have journeyman wrestlers. You know, the wrestler would come in and fight the big name, and you always knew he was going to lose. And so that's kind of what we are, is we're all four, I think, really good headliners. And that was the whole idea behind the thing, is four guys that may not normally get a chance to have anyone see them. That's what this is for. So, and if we can give all the money to the Children's Hospital, like, you really got no excuse not to watch it. You just turn the volume down and play it in the background. I don't care if you actually watch it. Just let's go do something. Let it run.
Absolutely. So you said that it's going to be episodic. Are they released? Is it all four episodes coming out on the same day, or is it going to be one at a time?
Yeah. All four of them right away. It was okay. It was made that way. I think the idea was to originally try to, you know, sell it to Netflix or Amazon or one of those. And it still may end up on Amazon someday. But, and then there's also we did an audio version of it as well, an audio album. And that's available for pre-order. Well, I think you said this is coming out later. But yeah, anyway, so there's an audio album as well on iTunes that you can download.
Yeah. Awesome. That's great. Well, congratulations on that. That's exciting. I hope it does man. Well. That's a good project to have coming out. This has been fantastic. Thank you for your time. Last thing, I guess, where can people, if they want to go find you, where can people go find you?
Just MikeMerrifield.com. You can find everything right there. And I should have changed my name to Merriweather a long time ago, because that's what most people call me, but it's Mike Merrifield. So, yeah. But everything's there. You can find the special there. All that stuff is right on the site.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Cool, man. Thanks for having me.
This has been brought to you by Dead and Mellow. Follow us on all your social media platforms and shop around at deadandmellow.com to see all of our stand-up, music, and podcast releases. Thank you, and God bless America.
All right, see you later.
Are we actually leaving or just ending?